Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Congressman Barney Frank on the prospects for Dodd-Frank on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, December 8th. Good to have you with us. As was entirely expected today, Republicans in the Senate blocked the nomination of Richard Cordray to be the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Wouldn't even let it get to an official up or down vote. The CFPB, as you may know, is the centerpiece of the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill that passed last year. So we called one of the guys whose name is on the thing to ask what ought to happen now. Democratic Congressman Barney Frank is the ranking member of the House Financial Services Committee. Congressman, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you.
Setting politics aside for just a second, we'll get there in a minute, but what are the practical effects of the CFPB not having a confirmed director? What can't it do?
There are a whole set of things it cannot literally do legally. We gave the CFPB and the law the existing statutory powers to protect consumers, which apply mostly to banks, to deposit-taking institutions. We, however, wanted to get to the non-banks, and people have noted, well, that's very important because there are a lot of problems with the non-banks. So payday lenders, check cashers, people who are in the remittance business, all of these people who do financial services who were not currently regulated by the Federal Reserve or the control of the currency, that's the set of powers that will not be there until we get a confirmed director.
All right, so let's get to the politics then. What does, if anything does, compromise look like to you on this?
Well, I don't mean to be rude, but
all right, go ahead.
Since you don't have a vote in the Senate, I really can't negotiate with you.
Well, no, seriously. What does compromise look like?
Compromise to me is that you follow the law as passed. This is an outrageous effort by the Republican minority in the Senate to use the confirmation power in lieu of legislation. If they want to try and change the law, they can try and change the law. I think this is one that we may have to take to the American public. I don't think the public is ready to give in to demands that the bank regulators be put back in charge of consumers, which is the major Republican demand.
So how are you going to take it to the American people? What does that mean?
We're having an election next year. And this, I think, is an issue that Republican senators who voted not to allow an up or down vote, who tried to wrench the Constitution out of shape and use the filibuster as a way to undermine consumer protection rather than take it on head on legislatively, let them defend that in the election.
Do you think the president should make a recess appointment in this case?
Oh, without question. When the Republicans, remember, they didn't reject Mr. Cordray because of any concern about his merits. When the Republicans say, we are not going to allow the process to work, we're not going to even consider a confirmation because we don't like the law which sets up the agency, then of course a recess appointment is called for.
You get a campaign for Elizabeth Warren this fall, the woman who many thought would be the director of the CFPB?
Yes. In fact, as I've said, I used to be the person in America most disappointed that the president didn't appoint her, but now Scott Brown is the person most disappointed. I'm second.
Scott Brown, who took Teddy Kennedy's seat. Last question for you, Congressman. You know, the White House knew back in May that the Republicans were not going to go for this. Was there not time to compromise back then?
No, I don't know why you keep talking about a compromise.
Well, because that's the way government's supposed to work, right?
It is, and that's how – no, here's how government's supposed to work. Look, the Constitution sets up two separate processes. Legislation, you vote on things, you get majorities in both houses, or you get two-thirds to override the Senate, and you can change something. The other is confirmation. Once there's an entity in place, it's their duty to vote yes or no. And to allow them to blackmail you by refusing to do the confirmation process into changing things is a great mistake. And to weaken an independent consumer bureau, look, the main thing the Republicans want is to say that the bank regulators, who frankly haven't done a very good job of consumer protection over the years, should be back in charge and should be able to overrule this independent bureau. Nobody's asking that the bureau be able to overrule the bank regulators in their area of jurisdiction. So no, compromise in this case, unfortunately, just means weaken.
Congressman Barney Frank, Democrat from Massachusetts. Thanks for your time, sir.
You're welcome.
Late leaks out of Europe today helped send all three major indices lower on Wall Street. Details, numbers, you know the drill. So here's what happened with the news out of Europe. It came in two phases today. Early this morning, the European Central Bank lowered interest rates and said it's not necessarily in the mood to buy large amounts of questionable European government debt. And then late this afternoon, there was a leak out of Brussels, site of all the frantic confabbing that's going on over there, that negotiations aren't going well in the Franco-German push for a new European treaty. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy say the EU itself, not individual countries, ought to have final say over budgets and deficits. So in front of the official meetings tomorrow, we sent Marketplace's Stephen Beard off to the European Parliament in Brussels to see how that idea is going over.
If you want to understand the depth of division in Europe, look no further than its lawmakers. At one end of the spectrum is Nigel Farage, head of the UK Independence Party. He doesn't see this summit as make or break for the euro.
Well, this is the eighth summit this year that we've been told was here to save the euro, so I think we should take that with a pinch of salt, really.
Not that Farage wants to save the euro anyway. He says it was always a mistake to shoehorn 17 very different economies into the same monetary system. In the corner of his office, he has an actual coffin with a euro symbol painted on the lid. He'd like to bury the common currency.
The euro itself is the problem, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to reinforce failure. That is just how damn stupid this whole summit is.
Farage doesn't just see the eurozone as the enemy, but the whole European Union, and he wants Britain out. 100 yards up the corridor from his office in the European Parliament, German lawmaker Alexander Graf Lambsdorff takes a very different view of the summit.
The summit is about creating credibility, to make it very clear to the outside world that the European Union is serious about defending the euro and serious about defending the member states of the eurozone.
Lambsdorff wants an ever closer European Union. On his office wall hang photographs of derelict border posts around Europe. For him, they symbolise the irrelevance of national borders in a united continent. He applauds the main plan being discussed here in Brussels, that unelected European bureaucrats scrutinise national budgets and fine countries that run up big deficits.
Which is very new for Europe, but I think it's the right way ahead if we want to have a credible fiscal union.
But that's the kind of talk that makes Nigel Farage seethe.
You know, the idea that a free independent country is hijacked and taken over by some faceless bureaucrat in Brussels, people won't stand for it.
He says trying to save the euro has propelled the EU down a dangerously undemocratic path. He points out that serving elected prime ministers in Greece and Italy have been replaced by unelected technocrats favoured by the European Union.
I mean, this is the nearest thing you will ever get to a technocratic coup d'etat.
And Farage was not impressed by the recent sight of Elsa Fornero, an unelected Italian minister, weeping as she unveiled more austerity on the orders of the EU.
You know, announcing cuts when she burst into tears. I mean, dear, oh dear, oh dear. Listen, you can cry as many crocodile tears as you like. The fact is, they are destroying democracy in Europe.
Not true, says Alexander Graf Lambsdorff.
Every country is free to leave the European Union or the Eurozone.
But he says Brussels has to exert much stricter central control over national budgets.
The sovereignty of each member state is untarnished by this, because the ultimate choice is to leave or to stay in. But when you stay in, you have to play by the rules.
However, Nigel Farage says the EU is getting more and more undemocratic. That coffin he keeps in his office. He and his colleagues wanted to carry it around the Parliament building in protest, but they were banned. In Brussels, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As Republican voters survey the 2012 field, they see what they want. This candidate has these strengths. That one has those. Eventually, there will be a meeting of the minds. Commentator Amity Schles says there's an emerging narrative to the GOP fight.
New is what candidates are supposed to be about. New to Washington, that is. President Obama, after all, represented something new when he was running for office in 2008. Our first black president, essentially an outsider, though he had been a senator for 25 months when he ran. That newbie, Sarah Palin of Alaska, was supposed to help Republican candidate John McCain. 2008 was a competition to show which party could be newer. This year, the GOP is fielding plenty of new candidates. John Huntsman and Mitt Romney have not represented a state in Washington. But Newt Gingrich is gaining popularity. Newt is not new. Gingrich is a legislative veteran who led a flawed budget balancing drive in the 1990s when he was Speaker of the House. Besides, Gingrich carries loads of baggage, multiple marriages, infidelities, a record of quarrels with other lawmakers. Why do Republican voters think he has a shot? The answer is that this election cycle is different. Voters want someone for president who is ready to sit down and rewrite Social Security in January 2013 and move on to Medicare repair the next month. A policy technician already familiar with the difference between defined benefits and premium supports before he gets to Washington. What voters remember about Newt was that some of his work laid the ground for balancing the budget. He was leaving the speaker's job by the time that happened, but that experience was key. In other words, Newt may be fresh, but this economy can't wait for a novice chief executive to climb up the fiscal learning curve. For 2012, old is the new new.
Amity Schles is a senior fellow in economic history at the Council on Foreign Relations. Do take a second to send us your thoughts. You can write to us at marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, you spend your money, you take your chances.
We want to see increased student achievement. We want to see the gap between income and ethnic groups narrow.
Our philanthropy series continues, Education Today. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the market's had a downer of a day. The Dow Industrials sank 198 points, 1.6%, signed off at 11,997. The NASDAQ down 52 points, nearly 2%, 2596, the number you're looking for. The S&P 500 gave back 26 points, 0.2%, closed at 1,234. U.S. bank stocks led the sell-off today. Morgan Stanley dove more than 8%. Citigroup down almost 7%. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs off 5% apiece. Another loser today, Costco returned almost 2%. The company reported rising costs ate into its earnings this quarter. Speaking of eating, we seem to be doing a lot of that at McDonald's. The fast food stock gained almost 0.5% thanks to higher global sales and the addition of the peppermint mocha to its U.S. menu. Yeah, peppermint mocha, I don't know. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for October. It's the United Nations International Anti-Corruption Day. And actor Kirk Douglas turns 95. Happy birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media is another way to say that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so you got the 1%, the 0.1%, the 0.01%, and then you got Albert Pujols. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim said today they've signed the all-star first baseman away from the St. Louis Cardinals. The deal is reportedly worth more than $250 million over the next 10 years. So baseball being a game of numbers, we thought we'd run our own. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins does the math.
Albert Pujols killed it in the World Series this year.
That ball is absolutely murdered.
He hit three home runs in Game 3 and led the underdog St. Louis Cardinals to win the series. For the Southern California reaction, I turn to
David Carter, potential Angels season ticket holder.
He's actually the executive director of the Sports Business Institute at USC. Under the deal, Pujols' yearly paycheck could add up to more than 10% of the Angels' annual revenue.
They would not have signed him if they did not believe that revenue was going to be increasing going forward from a variety of sources.
Starting with sponsorships. Jim Andrews of the sports marketing firm IEG says with Pujols, the team could bring in...
I would ballpark it, no pun intended, at $4 million, $5 million additionally next season.
Pujols' Dominican heritage will also pay off. John Greenberg is with Team Marketing Report.
You know, there's a ton of money to be made as far as Latin American companies. He's a dual threat. He can sell to anyone.
Pujols could also fill the Angels' 6,000 empty seats. That's another $8 million. And then there's merchandise. Pujols reportedly accounted for nearly half of the gear sold by the St. Louis Cardinals. And did I mention TV rights? They're about $50 million a year now, but in 5 years, they could triple if Pujols keeps up those home runs. But Pujols will have to pace himself. This contract will carry him until he's into his 40s. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
We're going to get back to our philanthropy series now, the hows and whys of what we give. And you know what? It's not always money.
What I can give as far as monetary has shifted. However, I believe there's plenty of ways that we can give that don't include money.
Clothes, items.
Usually we will give time.
Personally, I like to give blood.
I generally give to the Veterans Association.
Probably donating some toys for Toys for Tots.
I'm talking dollars. You know, hard dollars, because that's what people need in order to pay their bills.
That was Renee Ronnie from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, Curtis McKinney of Miami, Sarah McDonald of Denver, Brian Malady of Ridgewood, New Jersey, Alton Finley in Queens, New York, Jessica Ciosi of Westchester, New York, and Joseph Grodsky of Jupiter, Florida. We spend every year in this country about $600 billion a year on K-12 education. That's the all-in public number, federal, state, and local taxpayer money. Private philanthropists spend not even 1% of that, about $4 billion annually. But that $4 billion goes a long way, especially when it comes to school reform. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
On a winter day almost 100 years ago, Andrew Carnegie walked into Thomas Edison's recording studio in the Bronx and read from his essay, The Gospel of Wealth.
The man who dies thus rich dies disgraced.
The man who dies thus rich dies disgraced. It was a plea to the rich to give their fortunes away to make society better. Carnegie spent much of his vast steel wealth building libraries and universities. Today, a new crop of philanthropists is following his lead, pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into public education.
We have made public schools our top priority in the United States.
That's Microsoft's Bill Gates. Real estate tycoon Eli Broad and the heirs to the Walmart fortune have also made education a priority. And they're not just spending money. They have an agenda. The Walton Family Foundation favors school vouchers and charter schools. Broad's foundation teaches principals and superintendents to run schools like businesses. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the biggest of the big, wants to revamp just about everything.
These days in education, private funding is steering public policy.
Diane Ravitch is an education historian and the author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System. She says these billionaires have too much influence.
Public policy should be made through our democratic process. It shouldn't be determined because a foundation offers a large grant and says, do it my way.
Frankly, I think if private citizens and foundations want to put hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to work trying to improve schooling, we should probably regard this as a good thing.
Frederick Hess is director of education policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank.
What strikes me about this is not that these folks are doing anything differently than has historically been done in the past. It's that they're doing things educators don't necessarily like.
Like pushing for teachers to be evaluated based on student test scores and trying to make it easier to fire ineffective teachers. The Gates Foundation also funds advocacy groups to push its agenda and policy researchers like Rick Hess. It gives grants to media organizations like NBC, NPR, and yes, Marketplace for education coverage. Hess doesn't doubt their good intentions.
I think it's absolutely the case, though, that they run a risk of stifling critical views and of marginalizing voices who are raising important and even constructive issues.
Yet those who receive foundation money say it makes experiments in public education possible, especially when state budgets are drying up.
Our space
space, and you can hear in the background, we're still getting the finishing touches put on. And
this is Urban Teacher Center in Baltimore. Co-founders Christina Hall and Jennifer Green have just moved into their first real office in a renovated mill. The startup has received more than $1 million in Gates money to improve teaching in urban schools. Green says that kind of money just isn't available from the government.
At this economic moment in particular, the role of national philanthropists is especially essential because they tend to be more risk tolerant in seeding important new ideas that otherwise would not get off the ground.
Some of these ideas will inevitably fail. Last decade, the Gates Foundation spent a lot of money to promote small high schools and then realized it wasn't really helping kids. But with public spending on education per student falling in many states and the hunt for new budget cuts still on, schools needing money may rely even more on the generosity of the people who have it. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Amy mentioned a guy named Eli Broad, one of the big-time donors in education philanthropy. He's actually one of the world's big donors, period. He made his money in home building, later on insurance. He's taken a special interest in modern art, which made a visit to his offices here in Los Angeles the other day, not unlike a private museum tour.
These are all Jasper Johns prints.
But we didn't chat long about what was hanging on the walls. I wanted to ask him about the $450 million that his foundation has spent on schools over the past decade, and also about his methods. Things like the Broad Superintendent's Academy, getting more people with managerial skills into public school administration. But the first question I asked him when we sat down was why he gives to public education.
I'm a product of America's public schools and a land-grant university. And I think that we're looking at education today in what I call an antiquated system. The American classroom hasn't changed in 100 years. The biggest change is instead of blackboard with chalk, you've got a whiteboard with marker pens. And if you think of anything else in American society, everything else has changed by the use of technology and so on.
You mentioned your education, Michigan State University, public schools in Detroit.
Exactly.
Did they prepare you for what you needed to survive and thrive in this economy?
I think they did. But the world's changed since then. We weren't concerned with how kids were being educated in Korea, China, Japan, India, or certain European nations then. We were the United States of America. The world has changed, and we've got to do better.
There's a tactful way to ask this question, and then there's the expeditious way to ask this question, and so I'll go straight to that way. For all your experience, for all your resources and your success, what do you know about education?
Well, I know we're not getting a job done. I'm looking at student achievement. I don't see it growing rapidly. It has to. And how do you change it? You change it, in my view, by having better governance, better management, whether it's a superintendent or a principal. You've got to have better teachers, paid more money, incentivized, but held accountable.
You'll forgive me if I say that sounds spoken like a businessman.
Well, I'm not sure that some of the things you learn in the world of business or in government or other nonprofits can't be applied to education.
Is it for you a case of, just to keep with that business theme for a moment, return on investment? I mean, what do you want to see? What results do you want to see?
We want to see increased student achievement. We want to see the gap between income and ethnic groups narrow.
That's it. Boom.
That's what it's all about.
You have a program at the Superintendent's Academy to bring in business leaders, military leaders, civic leaders, and others.
And people from education.
And people from education. Is that the way to do it?
I think it is a way to do it. Because when we started 11 years ago, we saw most of the superintendents or chancellors start as a coach or a teacher without any training in management, labor relations, systems, communications, logistics, etc.
I wonder if something is lost when you have outsiders with resources coming in and saying, listen, here's what we think ought to be done.
Well, I think giving people new ideas and new thoughts and saying, look, you've got an antiquated system that needs to change. In the last several decades, spending in real dollars has gone up like 250%. But student achievement has been flat.
Are there things that educational philanthropy can't fix that you and foundations like yours, no matter the resources, just can't do?
Oh, we can't fix everything. We could come up with ideas, suggestions. We could train people that have competence, but that's all we can do.
Is there then a role still for public funding for education and local government control?
Education has to be publicly funded. Local control, I think we're now competing with too many other nations. We've got to have, in my view, for example, a uniform math curriculum across America. Probably the same thing in science also. And that's going to come from either governors or the U.S. Department of Education.
Is there a way that this economy gets fixed if education doesn't get fixed?
Education has to get fixed. Look, the gap between the 1% and 99% is far too great. And part of the reason is we've not done the job and education needs to be done.
Eli Broad, thanks very much.
Good being with you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, yesterday on the way out, I played you a bit of tape from Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan Chase, in which he said, basically, don't blame the rich for being successful. The bit I didn't play for you was where he complained about how much tax he pays. Most of us wage earners, he said, are paying 39.6% in taxes. Yeah, that's not true. Top marginal tax rate right now, 35%, which you'd figure, I don't know, a banker would know. All right, we'll leave Jamie Dimon alone for a while. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Thursday. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, Celeste Wesson, and Loretta Williams are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the broadcast, the European debt meetings deciphered and our weekly wrap from Wall Street and beyond, far beyond today, I think. I'm Kyle Risdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.